I think that we're in the middle of the age of genetics.
Here was the answer for sequencing DNA.
A single base pair in the more than 3 billion base pairs of the human genome.
The genome, it is very strange. What is all this DNA doing?
The gene is immortal.
This is Base Pairs, the podcast about the power of genetic information.
The great scientific challenges transcend national frontiers and national prejudices, for the language of science has always been universal.
Hey everyone, I'm Brian.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Base Pairs.
The power of genetic information has helped reveal many new treatment approaches to cancer, including a whole class of treatments known as cancer immunotherapies. Or so I thought, at least. I was under the impression that cancer immunotherapy, which uses the body's own immune system to fight cancer, was fairly new. But Brian told me that's not the case.
Yeah, I know you've been talking to a scientist who used genetic information to find a new cancer immunotherapy, which we'll get to later. But first, I have a story from way before anyone knew that DNA is the genetic material. It starts back in 1890 with a young woman named Elizabeth Dashiell. Her friends called her Bessie. Bessie is a young lady, about 17 at the time, and she's been traveling for summer vacation. She's excited because she's befriended a well-off young man who, by all accounts, has taken quite the liking to her. His name is John D. Rockefeller Jr.
So, if you know a thing or two about U.S. history, you know that this is a very fortunate situation for Miss Dashiell.
However, as with many memorable stories, this is where disaster rears its ugly head.
And she had injured her hand in a Pullman car, jolting.
That, I should say, is Pete Coley, and we'll get to where he fits into all of this in a second.
Okay, so something bad happened to Bessie, but before you continue, what is a Pullman car?
Yeah, alright, so basically, Bessie got her hand stuck between seats in a train car when it violently shook.
Okay, gotcha.
So, months later, the pain from the train car accident is still there. Bessie knows something is wrong and finds herself a surgeon in New York City, a man by the name of William B. Coley.
Oh, and how is Pete related?
William was Pete's grandfather and an up-and-coming surgeon at the time. However, when he examined his young patient, he found something unexpected. What had actually been causing Bessie's persistent pain was something unrelated to the Pullman car accident. It was something much, much worse.
Oh no, what was wrong?
Well, Coley knew a bone tumor called a sarcoma when he saw one.
Granddad, who was the surgeon, you know, he removed her hand and tried to save her with surgery, which is, it was the only thing going in those days.
But it wasn't enough. The aggressive cancer spread from Bessie's limb to the rest of her body, harrying the young girl with painful tumors. All Coley could do was make his patient comfortable, and in 1891, Bessie Dashiell died at the age of 18.
Oh man. Well, I've heard stories like this before, and I can guess where it leads. Coley was frustrated with how powerless he was, and sets out to improve cancer treatment options.
That's basically it, but this is where the story gets dark.
Brian, I'm pretty sure the story was already super sad.
Okay, but darker. Like, mad scientist dark. Fast forward 10 years later, and you've gotten an obsessive William B. Coley walking into hospitals looking for the sickest, most near-death cancer patients. He'd slice them with a scalpel and then rub a hodgepodge cocktail of bacteria into the wounds.
Whoa, what? Okay, that does sound mad. Why did no one stop him?
He got in trouble almost all of his life, but fortunately, he had a great reputation for integrity. And he did end up, you know, thanks to the Rockefellers and a few of his patients, he was able to get an endowment going for basic laboratory work. He had to be a a really live wire guy, as well as likable. Or else none of this would have happened.
And Coley wasn't only likable. People trusted in what he was doing because, believe it or not, he was onto something. Coley was chasing after what doctors at the time simply called spontaneous regression. Rare but documented moments when the tumors of a cancer patient simply disappeared overnight.
He began to research the case histories in New York especially, and he got people all around the world to try to find out what was a trigger for this. And they found that if there was an infection of some kind, it could be almost any infection, and with a big temperature and a big response, miraculously, cancer disappeared. It was amazing thing.
He first discovered an example of this phenomenon in the case of a German immigrant simply called Stein. Years before Coley's failure to save Bessie, Stein had been admitted to New York Hospital with a sarcoma very similar to hers. However, unlike the tragedy of Bessie Dashiell, Stein walked out of the hospital disease-free only a few days later.
That definitely sounds spontaneous. So I'm guessing Stein was hit with some kind of fever like Pete described.
Yeah, so through some medical record sleuthing, Coley learned that Stein had come down with a severe post-operative skin infection. Remember, this occurred during the late 19th century, when the idea of germs was just becoming popular. So many surgeons weren't even carefully washing their hands just yet.
Well, that worked to Mr. Stein's benefit. By getting infected, he somehow was able to beat his cancer.
Crazy, right? Coley even tracked the man down to a neighborhood in New York's Lower East Side. Years after developing sarcoma, there Stein was, with no sign of the cancer save for a scar on his neck.
So Coley surmised that the bacterial infection had somehow caused the tumor to regress, and decided to start purposely inducing infections?
The first cocktail he whipped up mostly contained the streptococcal bacteria.
That's the bacteria that causes strep throat.
But Coley experimented with other infectious agents as well. He called the mixture Coley's toxins, and according to his records, it was remarkably effective when it worked.
It's like being run over by a locomotive. I mean, whammo, and you'd have this huge temperature, and the sweats, and feel like you're dying of, you know, typhoid fever or something like that, which was a sign that, you know, the immune system had activated. I mean, it's a little, it was a pretty crude way of knocking the door down, but it opened up the immune system.
Oh, so the infection from Coley's toxins was basically jump-starting the immune system. Sort of waking it up to go fight off the bacteria, and in the process, it could also attack the tumor. That's super clever. And yet, it doesn't sound like Coley knew that this was what was happening.
Yeah. He had no idea what he was doing. He had no idea what he was doing. And nor did anybody else. Nobody at the time understood that there was an immune system. All the doctors in the world had never dreamed of it.
It's important to point out that a fascination with what would eventually evolve into a study of cancer and the immune system persisted in Coley's family. In the mid-1900s, his daughter Helen discovered 3,000 of Coley's case studies in the family barn, and soon after became one of the first champions of immunotherapy, founding the Cancer Research Institute. And Pete's father, Bradley Sr., continued to use a refined version of the toxins at Memorial Hospital well into the 1950s. Remarkably, some of his patients are still alive today thanks to this treatment.
So immunotherapy got its start through trial and error because so little was known about the immune system at the time. But in the century since Coley applied the first cancer immunotherapy, scientists have learned a whole lot more about how the immune system works.
If the problem in cancer immunology is turning on the immune system, well, we know the rules for that.
That's Professor Douglas Fearon, who runs a cancer research lab here at CSHL and has dedicated much of his 50-year career to learning what he likes to call the rules of the immune system.
Lack of understanding of those rules is why most of our listeners probably have never heard of Coley's toxins until now. The toxins worked in some patients, but not others, and since no one knew why, it quickly became overshadowed by another up-and-coming cancer treatment, chemotherapy.
Happily, Doug is closing in on a new cancer immunotherapy, one that doesn't use unpredictable infections, nor is it like the poisonous chemotherapies that are still used to treat cancer today. It's being tested in both colorectal cancer and pancreatic cancer patients right now. Doug and his team came up with the idea for this cancer immunotherapy by using genetic information and other tools to figure out how to use the rules of the immune system to their advantage.
If you understand the rules that govern the immune system, then you can imagine these manipulations for immunotherapy, promoting or suppressing immune responses.
So, I mean, that's really different from how Coley developed his immunotherapy. He had a hunch, and while a lot of work went into validating that hunch, his success also involved quite a bit of luck.
Yeah, Coley had a sense that if you can activate the body's natural defense, it might be able to fight cancer. But after decades of studying what we now know as the immune system, Doug believes that it is already trying to attack cancer in many cases.
I'm predicting that we will find that most patients have ongoing immune response against his or her tumor.
Really? Then what's stopping their immune system from just killing the cancer?
Something that I found pretty mind-blowing. Cancer is evil, but sometimes I can't help being impressed by its resourceful tactics. Research from Doug and other scientists suggests that cancer disguises itself from the immune system by tricking it into treating the tumor like a wound that needs to heal.
Maybe the problem is that the body thinks the tumor is a healing wound and it has to have mechanisms to protect the growing cancer cells. The body actually thinks the growing cancer cells is a regenerating tissue.
Okay, I know that cancer is so difficult to defeat, partly because it's an invasion that comes from within. Genetic mutations in our own cells send them down the path to becoming cancerous, but they are still similar to healthy cells in a lot of ways. So the problem is that the immune system can't detect the cancer cells because they look too similar to the healthy cells they started out as, right?
That's what I thought at first too. But the disguise is more clever than that. I was amazed when Doug told me about just how sensitive the immune system is. For example, in humans, genes are usually thousands of letters long. If just one of those letters is wrong, like if a C becomes a G, that tiny change in the protein created from that gene is enough to set off an immune response.
One point mutation, one amino acid substitution. Right, the immune system can see that as far.
All right, wow, that really shows how good the immune system is at its job, and yet the cancer still outmaneuvers it.
That's part of why Doug is so confident that many cancer patients do have an immune response to their tumors, and that he just needs to remove whatever is getting in the immune system's way.
Ah, and this is where learning the rules of the immune system must really come in handy.
Right. When Doug was based at Cambridge, he got interested in these cells called fibroblasts, which make structural materials like collagen, that stuff you often hear about in ads for beauty products, for example. Fibroblasts are also critical in wound healing and, curiously, are found in tumors.
Many people don't realize this, but tumors aren't made up of only cancer cells. They contain lots of healthy cells, too.
Doug had his own hunch. What if fibroblasts, these cells that help in healing wounds, were protecting the cancer cells?
So we made a mouse in which we could conditionally kill at any point in time the fibroblasts in a tumor. And we found if we did that, the immune system killed the tumor. So the fibroblasts were immune suppressive. That was the most unexpected finding. So then we simply isolated the fibroblasts and said, what genes are they expressing? How are they doing this?
Gene expression is kind of like a cellular activity log, so to speak. It gives a sense of which genes the cell is using at any given moment.
Yeah, and those tests revealed that the fibroblasts inside the tumor were making a particular molecule known to be involved in regenerating tissue, like what happens in wound healing.
And that is pretty darn suspicious.
This is the really strange part. It seems that the cancer cells fashion their disguises out of this special molecular material that they get from fibroblast cells.
Another cell in the tumor is making it, but the cancer cells are coating themselves, and this is somehow allowing them to prevent T cells from coming in to the cancer cell regions and attacking the cancer cells.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing, but also really distressing.
Yeah. Fortunately, that new cancer immunotherapy drug that we mentioned earlier prevents cancer cells from being able to put on this disguise. Now, Doug's lab at CSHL is working on figuring out why this molecular cloaking device exists in the first place.
This means by which tumors protect themselves from immune attack did not evolve for the sake of protecting tumors. Part of my lab is trying to investigate what normal circumstance contributed to the evolution of this tissue protective pathway. That's going to be relevant thinking about the biology of the system, but also be very clinically relevant. We'll need to deal with that in patients.
Doug was a medical doctor before he was a research scientist, and he never loses sight of the fact that he's doing research to benefit patients. Just like what happened with Coley, when Doug was practicing medicine, he felt like he was hitting a wall because he needed to know more about how the immune system works. Progress in medicine depends on improving our understanding of how the body works, and that comes from basic science.
Doug transitioned from being a doctor who treated patients to being a researcher in pursuit of discoveries that would lead to more effective treatments. For much of his career, Doug was actually more interested in turning off the immune system in autoimmune disease patients instead of turning it on against cancer.
And how did he end up studying cancer then?
Well, treating autoimmune disease more effectively turned out to be an even harder problem than he thought it would be.
And around 2005, 2006, maybe a little bit earlier, I realized I was getting a bit old and I had not accomplished the deal I had made by myself. I'll stop seeing patients so I can make a discovery that can affect the health of patients.
As he was thinking about where his chances of affecting the health of patients were the greatest, something serendipitous happened. He was asked to serve on the scientific advisory board for the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research. So he read up on cancer to prepare.
So I started reading cancer immunology, and it was an eye-opener. There were experiments done in the 1970s that allowed one to form hypotheses about why tumors escaped immune control. And I didn't feel as though it was being followed up by current cancer immunologists. And I had an idea. Maybe the fibroblast is creating the immune suppressive microenvironment and instructing all the immune cells to turn off.
Know
and then,
the,
best of all, the idea was right.
Now, Doug is not a boastful guy at all. So what you're hearing is pure excitement about making a discovery that could help patients. But how did he turn that discovery into a treatment? If the fibroblasts are suppressing the immune system, does that mean these immune-boosting supplements we hear about all the time could help fight cancer?
This immune-boosting craze came up when Doug gave a public lecture on immunotherapy here at CSHL with another doctor-slash-researcher named Robert Mackey. He's one of the leaders of a strategic affiliation between CSHL and Northwell Health, New York State's largest healthcare provider. Dr. Mackey still sees patients regularly, and here's what he had to say.
But the big question I'm always asked, I get this at least twice a clinic, a couple times today, in fact, is how can I boost my immune system? And pretty clearly the answer is you just call a cardiac surgeon. You know, Dr. Oz will be happy to tell you all the good things that you can do to boost your immunity.
That was a good burn.
Right, it really was. For those who would like to find out which supplements actually have scientific evidence to back them up, Dr. Mackey did also recommend something.
One thing I will recommend is that a lot of people do take supplements of some sort. Memorial Sloan Kettering have put together a very nice website called About Herbs, and this can tell you a lot about all these natural products that people are taking and what is purported to be useful about them and what the actual data are regarding that process.
Anyway, instead of learning immune-boosting strategies from cardiac surgeons like Dr. Oz, Doug was learning from scientists who study viruses.
Hold on, what do viruses have to do with any of this?
The cancer immunotherapy drug that Doug's team developed and is now testing in clinical trials was actually first developed to fight HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Dr. Mackey explained that this really makes so much sense because both viruses and cancer cells find ways to hide from the immune system.
This is what viruses have been trying to do throughout evolution. So EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, which causes mononucleosis, it's engineered itself. It's been selected against being seen by the immune system. It's really very much a stealth virus that has many ways of preventing the immune system from seeing it, for example.
And HIV must be pretty stealthy too, since it's so deadly when left untreated.
Yeah, cancer is far from the only swindler out there trying to cheat the immune system. HIV uses a similar tactic to the cancer cells that Doug studies, and so do other viruses. He actually learned about the drug he's now testing as a cancer immunotherapy when he was reading about West Nile virus.
I said, geez, that's kind of like what we want to do. So it was reading that paper that allowed me to choose that candidate as regulating T-cell infiltration in the tumor.
I would have never guessed that West Nile virus research could spark an idea for treating cancer. But that's why basic research is so darn fascinating and important. It's how scientists come to make discoveries that they couldn't have imagined in another context.
Doug is all about that. He came to CSHL in part because the culture around here allows scientists to spend lots of time learning about all kinds of research in biology, which helps them make valuable connections.
You can't design a life so you're terribly efficient. You had to have time to be inefficient, to read about things you don't necessarily know you need to know, but that's how you discover what you need to know.
I know we're kind of swinging our basic research pom-poms around here a little bit, but finding out what you don't know you need to know is quite the task. I'm glad Doug's hard work looks like it's paying off.
The clinical trials are still in an early stage, but so far so good.
The clinical trial is the analysis of the tumors by looking to see how the drug changes the immune reaction in the tumor. The analysis is done by looking at gene changes in gene expression in tumor biopsies before and at the end of treatment, 1 week of treatment. Our recent colorectal cancer patient trial suggests that at least half of the patients have T cells that are coming in and killing cancer cells after our immunotherapy.
That is fantastic. T cells are immune cells that are also sometimes called killer T cells because their job is to attack invaders. If they're responding, that suggests the drug is getting the immune system to do its thing.
It's pretty exciting. Doug just recently got the trial with pancreatic cancer patients up and running, and hopes that this very hard-to-treat cancer will respond to the drug as well. But even if that shows success, scientists in his lab are going to keep studying this system because
one naturally can believe that if we understand how something is happening, we can maybe make it happen even better. So that's what the work here, funded by the Lewis Garden Foundation, is totally focused on.
A scientist's work is never done.
That we know for sure. That's all for this episode. We'd like to thank Pete Coley and the Cancer Research Institute, as well as Professor Doug Fearon and Dr. Robert Mackey.
And thank you, artists. This episode, we included The Blue Dot Sessions, Scott Joplin, David Sedstay, Kevin McLeod, Broke for Free, and Mellow Stew. We'll be back next month with another new episode, but in the meantime, we'd love it if you'd review us on iTunes and let us know what you think of this show.
We're coming to you from Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, a private, not-for-profit institution at the forefront of molecular biology and genetics. If you'd like to support the research that goes on here, you can find out how to do that at cshl.edu. And while you're there, you can check out our newsstand, which showcases our videos, photos, interactive stories, and more.
And if that's still not enough, you can always pay us a visit. Between our undergraduate research program, high school partnerships, graduate school, meetings and courses, and public events, there really is something for everyone.
I'm Andrea.
And I'm Brian.
And this is Base Pairs. More science stories soon.
His name is John D. Rockefeller Jr.
So if you know a thing or two.
A thing or two. You know the things about...
Why did I start doing that? Okay.